Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You are listening to the Rethinking Faith podcast. I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and I'm glad that you're here. I'm a former pastor turned brewer with a deep love of theology and philosophy. Although I don't always wear the label comfortably, Christianity seems to be baked into who I am. I've found a home within the world of process relational thinking and have made close friends with the mystics. So whether you're a devout believer, a questioning skeptic, a bold atheist, or simply someone trying to figure out what it means to be human, you belong here. Thank you for joining me and taking the risk of entering into this sacred space. And thank you for reminding me that we aren't alone on this journey. Let us imagine a better way to be human together. Shall we begin? All right, friends, welcome back to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and joining me today, a blast from the past, if you will. It's been a long time since they've been on, but they are a previous guest, and that is Brian Zond. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Josh. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, I'm excited. It really has been a while. I think the last time you came on, I was looking through some of my stacks of books earlier, I think was when this came out, Postcards from Babylon. So however many years that was.
About 5 years ago or maybe more. I don't remember. Maybe 6 years ago. I don't know.
Oh, goodness. Well, that was the last time we talked. But
I'm looking at my stack of books. That was one, two, that was like five books back. I've written four since then or something like that.
Yeah, geez. Well, I'm excited to have you back on. I've continued to follow you and your work. Your work has been extraordinarily helpful for me throughout my own, you know, theological journey and such. And so most recently, you wrote a book about atonement theology, essentially, which is something I have not touched in a very long time. It used to take up, like, it was the primary question for me. It took up the most amount of mind space. And because of, you know, reasons that we don't have to get into, I had moved away from atonement theology. And even to the point where I was on a panel recently at a conference called God After Deconstruction, and someone asked the question of the panel, like, hey, tell us about how forgiveness works and the cross. I had no idea what to say, Brian. And so it was an interesting journey. I've really enjoyed reading your book. The, you know, publisher sent me this version, but I loved it so much that I had to get the pretty version too. So,
well, isn't the pretty
version? It's beautiful.
Nice. Yeah. It is.
It's very well done. And so all that to say, I'm excited to talk about a topic that's, I don't know, I guess perhaps a bit emotionally charged, very personal to me. And as I told you before we started, when I saw that you wrote a book about atonement, I was like, well, I've continued to follow Brian, and I trust Brian. So I think I can talk about atonement with Brian. So thank you.
And see, I would push back a little bit.
Okay.
The book is not entirely about atonement. I mean, it addresses that. It does show up. It's a book about the cross. Mm-hmm. And the cross is bigger than atonement theory, which is one of the main points that I really want to try to make. But I think you see what I'm saying there.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that's One of the things that I liked most about your book was that you kind of refuse to narrow down the cross, and rather it's a more expansive treatment that recognizes, like, hey, if we're only going to talk about atonement when we talk about the cross, or if we're only going to look at one atonement theory or something like that, then we're missing the larger picture here.
Yes.
And so it's an expansive understanding, which I thought was a breath of fresh air.
Good. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. So, all right. For starters though, I guess one thing that that also attracted me about the book was actually your subtitle. So the book is titled The Wood Between Worlds, and the subtitle, A Poetic Theology of the Cross. Mm-hmm. And so theopoetics, is something that I have more recently, started reading and getting into, and have found quite comfortable, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious, I'll ask you a personal question first. Why a poetic theology? Why did you feel the need to bring poetry into this kind of conversation about the cross?
Yes, a couple of things. First of all, I'm using the word poetry or poetics in a rather loose sense. As you know, it's not a book of poetry per se. It is a poetic approach to conversation about the theology of the cross. Poetic in the sense that I think that art is sometimes better at theology than theology is at theology. So the book draws upon, yes, poetry but also literature, song, film, paintings. And I don't know that this is novel. I mean, I think some people might think, well, my goodness, this what is this new thing that you have cooked up that you call theopoetics? Well, what's happened is, I mean, if you look at the Bible, and it's got way more poetry than you think it does. I think most people they go, yeah, okay, the Psalms are kind of like poetry, but really a whole lot of the Bible is. All of the Hebrew literary prophets, Isaiah through Malachi, that's all poetry. The Hebrew prophets were not preachers. They weren't social activists. They were poets. The first two chapters of the Bible are two versions of poetic account of creation. You get into the New Testament, Paul in his best passages is poetic. You think maybe Romans 8, 1 Corinthians 13, passages in Ephesians and Colossians. There's the hymn of the cross in Philippians chapter 2. And I would think you could describe the Gospel of John as a poetic gospel. And the conclusion of the New Testament is this wild, fantastical, apocalyptic poetry of John the Revelator. So what's happened, though, is in modernity, we sort of lost any patience with the poetic. And we fell in love with the precision of prose. Prose has its place. I mean, if you're reading instructions for how to assemble a bicycle, you probably don't want it in poetry. But the problem is, the Bible is not an instruction manual, and it shouldn't be approached that way, even though I know people do, but I think that's a terrible way to approach it. Poetry or poetic language or a poetic approach may be at times less precise, but it's also less limiting. And let's face it, when we are trying to, theology is how we think and talk about God, which verges right on the ineffable. I mean, we are trying to speak about that which probably cannot be spoken of. And so our recourse is metaphor and very often poetic language and other forms of art. So I realize that in modernity, this may be a new approach to theology, but historically, it's actually the more common way to approach poetry. And now as we're coming to the end of modernity, maybe entering post-modernity, I think you're going to see theopoetics become more and more employed in how we engage in conversation about God, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm quite fond of the theopoetics, and I think partially too, I have to give some credit where credit is due. I think so just a little bit of background context for you, so you know who you're talking to. Last time we talked, which I don't live under the assumption that you remember talking to me in the past, but I was a pastor at the time. I am no longer that. I left vocational ministry. I became a professional brewer making beer, which I did for about 3 years. And then most recently, about 6 months ago, I found myself as the parish administrator in a tiny little Episcopal church in Ellicott City, which is not too far from where I live here in Baltimore. And
the Episcopalians will appreciate having a brewer among them.
Yeah.
I know this, yes.
Absolutely.
It's a good thing.
I'm fairly confident that's like the thing that put me over the edge for the priest. It was like, this is it, yeah. They showed the vestry and the senior warden was like, wait, this guy can make beer, bring him in. but being in that space and learning the liturgy, something that I didn't really have access to in my evangelical pastor days. Right. And help, you know, because I'm crafting these bulletins every week and I'm having to learn how the liturgy works. And it's a very, this isn't the best language for it, but you would know what I mean, like high church, Episcopalian church, so it smells and bells. And being in that space, surrounded by the iconography and this beautiful embodied spirituality, lended itself nicely to poetry, I guess. Yeah. And it helped me open up in a way to wrestling with your book. Cause it like I really did. Reading your book felt like a wrestling exercise for me, because there were times when I was like, oh man, I don't know. This is whatever. And then there was times when I was like, oh okay. Yes. Yes. I'm here for this. And I think part of that distinction, I heard you talk recently with a buddy of mine, Trip Fuller. You did a conversation with him and John Dominic Crossan, and you made a distinction in that episode that really kind of opened me up more, and it helped me. You talked about the scholarship side of things, and you talked about so like Brian as a scholar, but also Brian as a pastor.
Right.
And there was a distinction there. And so for me, when I was wrestling with your book, understanding that helped me. And I guess, for example, and then I want you to comment on it, forgive me for being long-winded, but particularly there's a chapter where you talk about like, what did Jesus think about, you know, Jesus's
mission. His own bit.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, well, I know Brian's going to pull from John here, because of course he is, because it's like, you know, the most, you know, the highest Christology, blah, 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 whatever. So the scholarly side of me was like annoyed. But then the pastoral side of me was like, I love all of Brian's conclusions. So it was this weird tension inside of me. So I'm curious, that scholar pastor tension, do you see it? Do you see what I mean? Or do you see it as
a
tension?
But I have a freedom because I'm not from the academy. I'm not intimidated by the academy because, just to be honest with you, Josh, I've read all the stuff. Okay. So, as far as academic theology goes, I've read it all and I appreciate it. I actually do. I really do appreciate it, and I've benefited from it. But I'm not beholden to it. And the academy mostly writes for itself, and it's sort of, it's scholars talking to scholars, and it sort of goes around in circles. There are reasons for that are commendable. I mean, it has to do with, you know, peer-reviewed scholarship. You're not just going to just jump right out and start making theological proclamations without having, you know, someone sort of vet that you might know what you're talking about. But on the other hand, if theological conversation abides entirely in the academy, well, then what's the point? I mean, when the day is done, I'm still a pastor, meaning that I think there must be a way to convey these theological insights to the person who is never going to read an academic work of theology in their life. They're never going to do it. And God bless them. They don't need to. I mean, not everybody needs to do that. Some do. I do. A few do. But if, you know, the theology should not be the private Provence of a few elite. And so that's why I do what I do. I sort of inhabit two worlds, or I try to act as a bridge between the two worlds. I try to metabolize academic theology and then communicate it in a way that is non-academic. And that's also why employing theopoetics, film, art, painting is, I mean, I don't have anybody that's going to look, you know, cockeyed at me about that. Or if they do, I don't care. So I'm operating from freedom.
Yeah, I like that word freedom. It's something that I, well, in a different way, I experienced after kind of leaving vocational ministry, because part of that was I felt I didn't have the freedom to think about the kind of things I was thinking about or reading the things I was reading. But I think that freedom is demonstrated so nicely within this book. Again, Brian, I really did enjoy it. I've recommended it to a number of people. It's hard because I don't really know where to jump in because there's so much present here. But I guess, all right, let's do this because, yeah, let's start with this idea of the grotesqueness of the cross, because this is something that I hear a lot from friends of mine who are maybe spiritually curious, or maybe they kind of have some kind of Christian understanding, but they like not really. I have a friend that comes to mind named Dustin. And whenever I talk to him, he's like, Josh, why is every image of Jesus just him dead on a cross? It's like blood everywhere. It's gross. Why don't they have like Buddha Jesus or something like that? So the grotesqueness is something that you wrestle with in one of your chapters and kind of parallel that or contrast it with beauty. So how do you see the kind of grotesqueness and beauty of the cross coming together?
Yeah, this is one of the more remarkable things about the cross in Christian art and Christian theology, that we are capable of portraying it in terms of beauty. This is actually so remarkable that I'm afraid we've become accustomed to it. So if we had a journalistic photograph of the events of Good Friday, let's employ some anachronisms here. Let's say, you know, some photographer from the Jerusalem Post goes out to Golgotha on Good Friday and takes a picture of what's occurring. If we had that, we might look at it once, regret that we did, and never look at it again, because it would be abhorrent. There would be nothing beautiful. It would be repulsive because, you know, the Romans are not trying to create art when they're crucifying people. They are employing crucifixion as a means of psychological terror to keep an oppressed people under their thumb. And yet eventually the cross became depicted. Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned this in my book. I'm actually at my writing desk. This is where I also do these Zooms and stuff like that, podcasts. And I have this, I mentioned this book. Maybe there's a picture of this in the book. This is my cross icon that presides over all the writing I do. I think of it that way. So when I go to write, I light a candle in front of this and it presides. Now, if you look at this, I mean, I don't know how a person could look at this and not just at least initially say, oh, that's beautiful. Because it is. It's an exquisite piece of art that takes literally a magnifying glass to appreciate the real subtle detail in it. But hold on a second. It's five. There are five scenes depicted here. Christ carrying his cross, crucified, taken down from the cross, buried, and then there's resurrection. So four of the five scenes are grotesque in nature. They are depicting a human being tortured to death. And yet we look at it and we say, oh, this is beautiful. That's, I think, strange. And I think we should not just rush past the strangeness of that. What's going on is the belief that there is more occurring on Good Friday than the raw data of just another crucifixion, which I think sometimes it's easy for people to imagine that crucifixion was rare and exotic. It was not. It was disturbingly common. I mean, one of the scandals, I guess, of the cross of Christ is he wasn't even afforded the dignity of his own lone crucifixion. He was but one of three that day. So why are artists making a mistake when they combine the grotesque with the beautiful? Because it would be possible to produce reproductions of the crucifixion that were entirely grotesque, with nothing beautiful. But that's typically not what's done. It's a mixing of the two. Is that appropriate? Well, let's remember that the role of the artist is not that of the journalist, and the role of the journalist is not that of the artist. The role of the journalist is basically just to present to us the raw data. The role of the artist is to alert us to what we may have overlooked on the surface. So you think of Van Gogh's Starry Night, famous painting, the swirls of stars. You know, it's probably his most popular, hangs in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Is that a, well, realistic depiction of what you see on a starry night? Of course not. But that's not what, I mean, Van Gogh isn't a journalist. He's an artist, and he's trying to wake us up. Van Gogh is saying, hey, you're missing it. Wake up. What occurs, what we see on Van Gogh's canvas is what should occur in our soul when we behold the beautiful and mysterious grandeur of a starry night. So artists who depict the crucifixion of Christ and actually bring beauty into it are actually doing theology. I mean, that's actually a theological move that, yes, we know about the ugliness, the violence, the brutality, the death that was all present, but there's also, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. There's mercy, there's love. There's, if you want to push it to the extreme, there is the refounding of the world. There is, I mean, as I say in my book, the cross of Christ is the wood between the worlds. There is the world that was and the world to come, and between those two worlds is the wood upon which the Son of God was hung. And so, but I don't think we should. I mean, there's another image that I don't put in the book because I couldn't, I don't know, the publisher probably would have allowed it. I don't know. But I didn't know, I couldn't locate the cartoonist to get permission for it. But I do describe it very early in the book. And I think it's a, I just laugh every time I think of it. It's a brilliant cartoon. It's both profane and profound. And so here's the cartoon. Aliens from outer space have landed on Earth in their flying saucer. They've just exited their flying saucer. This is their first moment on Earth. They happen, by chance, to have landed beside a life-size roadside crucifix, the kind you'll see in Spain. So this is the first thing they know about this planet. And they're looking at this crucifix. And one alien says to the other, you know what we need to do? We need to get the F out of here. That's what we need to do. And what's brilliant about that cartoon is it helps you see the strange absurdity of the cross through alien eyes, literally, you know, because aliens. And the aliens, they've concluded that a planet where people erect public depictions of crucified victims must not be a safe place. And they're not wrong. So I guess one of the first things I want to do in the book is recover both the strangeness, the anthropological absurdity, and the scandal of the cross, but then return to the possibility of it also being beautiful. All right, that was a long-winded reply. Sorry about that, Josh.
No, that's good. Thank you. I love that the cartoon. I actually laughed out loud and Googled it for myself. And
did you
also
find it?
Found it wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it?
It is. And I think too, the heart at which you're getting at for me is like helpful in the sense that I remember previous versions of Josh looking at the cross and trying to get this kind of scientific, like, this is what happened kind of thing.
Right.
And that misses the point. But bringing into this the mystery, as you talked about it, of both the beautiful and the grotesque, kind of like reawakens something inside of me, I guess. And learning to sit and just be comfortable in that mystery instead of need, you know, the certainty kind of thing. I mean, it even led me to the point where I went out and I purchased a crucifix for myself, which is not something I had had.
It's a San Damiano crucifix.
Yeah. I was rather uncomfortable with having one, but have since done so. And it hangs right above my head here in my podcasting space in my office.
You know the story of that particular crucifix?
I do not. I just know that I find it beautiful and it's hanging in the the church proper at the Episcopal.
Let me tell you about that. That
sure.
is a reproduction of what is known as the San Damiano crucifix that you will find in Assisi, Italy. I've seen the original, and the original is quite large. It's a Byzantine crucifix, but what makes it famous is that after Francis of Assisi had gone off, you know, he had these aspirations to be a gallant knight, and he went off to battle, and it wasn't as romantic as he thought it would be. He was wounded, probably deeply traumatized, ended up a prisoner of war for like a year, a prisoner of war, maybe. Let's say he was just held prisoner by the rival clans of, I forgot the name of the town, starts with a P. Okay, it's right on tip of my tongue. It doesn't matter. Until his father was able to ransom him. And this guy, this, you know, he's a young man at this point. He's like in his early 20s, who had been sort of known as the, I don't know, the life of the party. He was the one that would fund, you know, the parties. And he was a jovial, outgoing guy. Had become, probably due to some form of PTSD, brooding and melancholy, and he was slipping off more and more. And he found this old abandoned church. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't in use anymore, but it still had this crucifix, that crucifix. And he would go there and pray. And one day, as he's looking upon this crucifix in prayer, Jesus speaks to him and says, "Francis, rebuild my church, which you see has fallen into ruins." And initially, he takes it literally. And literally, you know, he begins to gather stone and hire some stonemasons and others to rebuild this chapel. And he does. But then he comes to understand that, no, there was, Jesus is actually talking about rebuild my church, which here in, you know, the 13th century was falling into the ruins of corruption. And this is how Francis begins his ministry. That's the San Damiano crucifix. You got a good one there, Josh.
Well, I'm glad I got a good one. Yeah, and it really is beautiful. And I mean, even to the point where when I purchased it and I hung it up, it had been sitting in the office here for probably about a week or so. And my wife, who, because of what she saw the church do to me, basically my negative experience, she has since kind of, you know, not really want anything to do with that. She even commented on the beauty of this crucifix and how much she liked it. And so that was more affirmation for me. I was happy to have it. And I don't know, there's just something about it. I mean, these darn Episcopalians are getting to me, Brian, where the iconography and the liturgy is doing something to me.
Look, I spoke this past weekend in Tulsa. I was invited to come and do, you know, half a day's presentation on the wood between the worlds. Tulsa, Oklahoma, the home of the land of 10,000 charismatic churches. And it was an Episcopalian church that invited me. And we had a lovely time, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. So one thing too that I think of, and this is going to be me getting into the nerdy side of myself, so forgive me, but one thing that I loved about that beauty and grotesque aspect as well is, so I'm a process relational thinker, and this kind of understanding that in each moment of becoming, the divine is taking into the divine self, you know, everything that's happening, right? And in, you know, takes it in, evaluates, and then puts, you know, in the next moment of becoming, something before us that is good and beautiful and true, you know, luring us into those things. And so what's cool about that is things that are evil and ugly and bad, which obviously happen, is taken into the divine in each moment of becoming. It doesn't, you know, overcome the divine, but rather is taken in, evaluated, and then given into the next moment, the next best possible thing that is good and beautiful and true. And I think in Christianity, we call that grace. But it's this taking of the grotesque and offering it as beauty in each moment. And when I read that chapter, that's kind of what was playing in the back of my mind. And I was like, oh, yes, this language still resonates with me in that kind of, you know, more processy register. What do you think?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. And that the cross can be depicted in terms of beauty that is not kitsch. It's not contrived. That the reality of crucifixion is still present, but the overall presentation is that of beauty. Oh, I think that's only possible. I mean, I'm going to say something kind of out on a limb here, but I think that's only possible because of the true nature of the cross. And that when I speak of the cross or the crucified Christ, I always mean the crucified risen Christ or the cross in light of resurrection. Because without that, well, I mean, you never hear of Jesus of Nazareth, Galilean Jew, put to death during the governorship of Pontius Pilate circa AD 30. I mean, as I said earlier, crucifixion wasn't rare, it was common, but you've never heard of any of the crucified victims except this one, because we see it in the light of resurrection. So if the cross can become a symbol actually of beauty, but of grace, because you use that word, of hope, well then that's the ground for all of our apokatastasis hope. That's that Greek word meaning universal restoration. And A cross depicted in terms of beauty is a harbinger of hope that indeed in the end all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well.
Amen. I love that's is that I want to mess that's up. That's Julian of Norwich, right? Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Another aspect that really resonated with me in your book is actually two chapters. They're separate by a good bit within the book, but I think they're closely linked in ways that I think are obvious, that you'll find obvious. But like, you have a bit on like God on the gallows, and then also the lynching of the Son of Man. And why particularly the gallows aspect speaks to me is because, as a process person or open and relational, whatever language you like, this idea of a God that suffers is deeply compelling and moving to me, right? That's part of why I have embraced that kind of theology, is because it's a God who knows what it's like to be Josh Patterson and knows what it's like to suffer as Josh Patterson. Not that I've ever been, you know, hung on a cross or something like that.
It's why I say that open theism ultimately is a theodicy. That's what it is. It's a theodicy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's part of why I got into it was, I mean, essentially the problem of evil, suffering, these kind of things, was that theodicy. And so you have that aspect. And then the lynching aspect really speaks to me, because if you remember that panel that I told you about, the first thing that came to mind for me was like, I don't really know if I can talk about forgiveness right now, but when I think of the cross, I think about the God who chose to die in solidarity with mm-hmm. all of those who have died cross dead. Yeah. Whether that's black bodies in America that have been lynched literally in trees or in the streets, whether that's LGBTQ people who have been murdered and thrown up on fences, whoever that is, that for me, that's the deepest resonance I have right now when I think about the cross, is the God that chooses solidarity with all of those who die cross dead.
And this is why I push back so determinedly against trying to interpret the cross as a single atonement theory. Oh, I'm weary of that. What has happened, I think I can just say what I think. What's happened in Protestant Reformed theology informed Christianity over the last 25% of the history of the church is that one aberrant atonement theory has become like an invasive species within our theology and crowded all any other way of talking about the cross. And so I've done debates on this, I've written on this, and I try to deal with it pretty early in the book and get on with it, because I'm not really interested in having, you know, my 428th argument about penal substitutionary atonement theory and its aberrant nature within the history of Christian theology. But even if that atonement theory were a valid way of talking about the cross, and I'm convinced it's not, it would be problematic in that it becomes the sole meaning of the cross. So the adherents of that particular theory are able to sum up the meaning of the cross in one or two sentences and then go, I'm all done with it. That seems like that seems like a wrong move to me. One of the problems with that particular atonement theory, again, I'm not interested in rehashing that for the 429th time, is that it lets, for example, the principalities and powers just go scot-free. The cross has nothing to say about that, but the cross has much to say about that. And so I will say this much. If you are going to dabble in atonement theory, at least keep it plural. You know, to reduce the cross to kind of one meaning is an impoverishment of the richest source of theology within the Christian faith. And so what does the cross say about Auschwitz? What does this cross say about lynching in the Jim Crow South? What does the cross say about theodicy and God's presence among suffering? It has a lot to say. And so let's open the door. I'm not suggesting that anything that anybody would say the cross means is valid. I mean, it'll go through its vetting process within the conversation of the church. But to reduce it to a single meaning, that seems to be very dismissive.
Yeah, I think very dismissive and also ahistorical. It fails to wrestle with how the church has continued to ask the question, what does the cross mean? Which is, I love that. I mean, I love that you focused that on the book. It's like like a kaleidoscope image, or I think of maybe even like a stained glass painting image where all of the little pieces are important, and you don't really know the whole story without each little one. But if you just focus on one, you're missing the larger, beautiful thing. Yeah, and I mean, I think the history bit is really important too, because I think one tendency that I used to have, and hopefully I'm recovering from this, is finding images of, now, all right, I want to be fair in how this is. I'll say it first. Finding images of the cross that I don't like and just ditching them outright and ignoring them and failing to recognize.
I have plenty of those that I don't like. Yeah, that's
absolutely
all right.
And there are some that I really do not like. But trying to be fair, I guess, and recognize in this in the historic moment when that particular theory kind of became the most popular one, at least recognizing the context of what that was happening, and maybe look at, okay, maybe the theory itself kind of sucks and I think it makes God an asshole, but the relational aspect of it, the message that's trying to be communicated, can still be beautiful, even if I'm like, all right, that theory kind of sucks. But what's the relational aspect here? What's the beauty that can be found within it? And so that, I think, I don't know, the historical context matters. And that doesn't mean that today we have to embrace historical contexts that don't make sense for us, but we can still, at least, I guess, recognize the beauty of in where the church has been and kind of build on tradition in a way to honor tradition, but not be subservient to tradition. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the book is 19 chapters with kind of a long poem at the end. So I would say, and each chapter is sort of freestanding in one sense. And you mentioned that, yes, I talk about it being kaleidoscopic. You know, a kaleidoscope, you look at the source of light, you look through the lens, you see colors, shapes, geometric design, and then you turn the kaleidoscope and it's still the same source of light, but you have a different design in different colors. So I don't think I've ever said this before. I don't think I've really thought this before, but I'm thinking it now. That I don't know. I think I'm hard to pin down. You know, I don't fit easily into a theological or ecclesial category. But I know a lot of people, you know, they have their camps and positions. I think most Christians that are somewhat open-minded would find something in this book that they like, that they agree with. Now, they might find plenty they disagree with, but this is maybe, and that's not why I did it that way. I wrote it that way because that's actually how I'm seeing the cross. I'm seeing it in many different ways. But I am convinced that unless somebody is just deliberately trying to be a crank, that most Christian thinkers could find one or two or three chapters that they go, yeah, but I like that. I like that. I like that. And I don't know, that just seems like a good thing to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it honors the breadth, however you say that word, and depth of the tradition in a way that's really beautiful. And I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think so. I agree with you. I'm trying to see here. I have a few of the chapters written in front of me that really resonated with me. All right. I feel like we have to talk about Lord of the Rings. I really loved that chapter. And
that was my favorite chapter to write.
You wrote it very well. And that's, I mean, the kind of like the ideas that you were wrestling with is basically that's how I got into your work. It was very, you know, the critiques of power and the grasping for power, you know, some of the more like Anabaptish, you know, nonviolent, like some of the things you talk about in like War is Over is how I found you. And
that would be my books like A Farewell to Mars, maybe Postcards from Babylon, some others. Yeah.
These kind of things. Yeah. But the Lord of the Rings chapter was wonderful. The metaphor you drew on grasping for that ring and how that ring ultimately corrupts, and it needs somebody like a humble hobbit to carry it, and almost they too failed. It was a wonderful chapter.
what was so fun about writing that chapter is I just got to work with Tolkien, and I am not I have not achieved Lord of the Rings nerd status because there are people out there that, wow, they know their Tolkien.
Shout out Trip Fuller and Nick Polk.
Yeah,
y'all are a bunch of Tolkien nerds.
I did a podcast with Trip on Tolkien when he was doing that whatever he's doing series, and I told him in private, I said, "Come on, Trip, I don't know that I mean, yeah, I've read it 4 times and I've seen the movies a gazillion times, but I don't know that I'm vetted, you know." He said, "Ah, well, we'll just talk about wizards and stuff. You'll love it." And it was fine, but. I'm kind of a literary snob. I'll just tell you this about me. I read a lot of highbrow literature. You know, I can read my James Joyce and, you know, read whatever, Light in August and all these sorts of things. And I like that. I like some obscure modernist writers like Antonio Lobo Antunes from Portugal or John Fosse. Oh gosh, I love him, from Norway. But when the day's done, I've probably never read anything more enjoyable than The Lord of the Rings. I just, it's just, you know, if somebody says, "Oh, you're gonna have to read that book again," I'm like, "Well, I'm happy to do it." And so there's so many themes in it. It's probably more Christian than people realize. Fleming Rutledge, who is a theologian that I admire and respect and somewhat fear. she's been kind to me. She's endorsed some of my work and all that, but she's one that you don't want to trifle with. She doesn't suffer fools gladly. And I had tweeted, I don't know, a couple of years ago, that I was watching Lord of the Rings with my grandchildren, who were some of the ones that were watching were probably 8 or 9. And she immediately sent me a message chiding me. She said, "No, you know," she just told me why that was wrong. "They have to read the book before they see the movie." And I was like, "Sorry, Mrs. Rutledge." But then she sent me a copy of her book, Battle for Middle Earth. She sent me a copy, signed it and all that. And what that book is it's a Christian commentary on The Lord of the Rings. And it's really good. I mean, it's actually really good. And I quote a little passage from it simply because, I quoted in that chapter, because in that passage, she quotes Bob Dylan. And I thought, oh, I have an opportunity to quote Fleming Rutledge quoting Bob Dylan. I am not going to miss this. So I found a way to work that in. So I just want people out there to know, now the door is open for someone to quote Brian Zahn quoting Fleming Rutledge quoting Bob Dylan. It's like Inception. It just keeps
I'll work it into my writing project. I'll let you know.
As Brian Zahn says, as Fleming Rutledge says, as Bob Dylan says.
Be like that, like when Michael Scott quotes, I guess it's Wayne Gretzky. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, that.
So what I'm doing with that chapter is I've used the language a lot about contrasting the cross of Christ with Caesar's sword. And yeah, I've done that. It's just a lot. I mean, it shows up in probably all my books in one way or another. But I thought, well, you know, that may be tiresome or people may not resonate with that. There's a whole lot of people out there that get the Lord of the Rings. And the most resonant theme I find in that book is the inability of anyone to use the ring, A, for any good, and B, and not be corrupted by it. And the only people or beings or whatever that have a chance to bear the ring and not be utterly corrupted by it are the humblest of all, these hobbits. You know, they just like their, you know, their gardens and their beer, and, you know, they're not aspiring to rule the world. And but even Frodo in the decisive moment was not able to willingly relinquish it. It took the hand of providence working through Gollum. Only Samwise Gamgee, who, by the way, now everybody knows he's the true hero of the book. Only Samwise Gamgee he's the only person who was able to willingly bear it for a time and then relinquish it, because he's the gardener, you know, he's the humblest. And yeah, anyway, I enjoyed writing that chapter. I really did.
Yeah, and that chapter so speaks so nicely to the kind of cultural, you know, moments we find ourselves in, where at least in my opinion, there are particular parts of the church that are grasping for the ring,
yeah,
or for the sword of Caesar, as you said. And even, I mean, even Gandalf, right? This powerful mm-hmm. wizard that was like, if I'm getting my Lord of the Rings correctly, like sung into existence, right? Yeah. Even Gandalf was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I don't think I can handle it.
He said, no, I dare not take it, even to keep it safe. The temptation to use it would be too great, even for my strength, and I don't want to become like the Dark Lord himself. And then he says this. He says, the way of the ring to me would be through pity and a desire to do good. But once it got a hold of me, all that would matter is power. And I would be corrupted by it, and I would commit unspeakable works of evil. That's all powerful stuff.
Deeply powerful. And I mean, it reminds me too of a conversation I had recently on the podcast with Lenny Duncan. Lenny put out a book recently called Psalms of My People, where they engage hip hop as kind of a way to tell stories of Black liberation. And Lenny in the book, you know, bemoans capitalism and talks poorly about, you know, billionaires and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time is willing to say, but guess what? If I got all that money one day, you better believe I'd be out there buying some really stupid shit and not spending my money in ways that I think are appropriate. So
it's why I alluded to this a little bit in the chapter, but I didn't really flesh it a lot. It's why I can tell you that I've been a pastor for 42 years. Of one church, 42 years. And over the last 20 years anyway, I've received numerous invitations to participate in events at the White House from both parties. You know, both the elephants and the donkeys both invite me. And I just, as a matter of principle, I decline. I don't have to decide, well, I'm for this team, I'm not for that team. I just don't go because I don't trust myself not to be swept away with the proximity to that kind of power. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm a little bit like Gandalf. I'm just going to stay away from that. I'm not even going to touch it. So I just stay away. I don't think breakfast with Caesar is a very good idea.
Mm-hmm. Not for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's so reminiscent too, right, of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. At least that comes to mind for me. It's here's the power. Thing. Here you go. Take it.
Well, and this is, you know, to one of my all-time favorite novel, if not The Lord of the Rings, it's The Brothers Karamazov. Mm-hmm. And by the way, The Brothers Karamazov is also probably my favorite theological work. And the most famous passage in that is The Grand Inquisitor, this parable by Ivan Karamazov to distress his novice monk little brother, Aloysius. And in it, he concocts this fictional meaning of the Bishop of Seville during the Inquisition encountering Christ, taking him prisoner, and then explaining to him that why he did the wrong thing in all three temptations. That he should have turned the stones to bread, and he should have leapt from the pinnacle of the temple, and he certainly should have taken the offer from what he calls the dread spirit to rule the world through force. It's a brilliant, brilliant passage. So they're all tied together in various ways.
Yeah, and they're all kind of floating around. And I mean, I love one of the last sermons I ever preached vocationally was on the temptations of Christ, and I still come back to that mm-hmm. bit. rather frequently. But I guess, all right. So one thing that I always found interesting when I was pastoring and kind of had this nonviolent bent to me, or Anabaptish bent to me, as some people have said, was I was always confused the kind of pro-life ideal, but then at the same time, I noticed a lot of the people that were claiming to be pro-life also supported something like capital punishment and the death penalty.
Yeah.
And you tackle that in one of your chapters. But what's curious to me is people have literally told me, I support capital punishment and the death penalty because without it, I wouldn't have my salvation.
Yeah.
It blows my fucking mind,
that's,
Brian.
That's such bad theology. I mean, that's theology, okay?
Bad theology. Yes. So I really enjoyed the your capital punishment.
It's the American obsession with the mistaken idea that justice equals punishment. Justice does not equal punishment. Justice means to rectify, to set right. It means to set right that which is wrong. That's what justice means. But in the American mentality, justice is little more, and perhaps at times nothing more, than punishment. But punishment may be part of a rectifying process, but punishment as an end to itself, or as the total solution to the problem, that's there's nothing of sound theology or even philosophy about that. And this is part of the strangeness of America. This is a bit of American exceptionalism, even in the evangelical world. Evangelicalism is not restricted to the United States. You'll find expressions of it all over the world. But one of the glaring distinctions between American evangelicals and global evangelicals is their position on the death penalty. And look, I mean, what countries actually, for all practical purposes, practice the death penalty? Islamic states, totalitarian states, and the United States. And we're completely at odds with the position of the church for its first 300 years. It was only after the church got involved in the interests of the empire and became the imperial church that it then began to talk about perhaps we can theologically justify war and capital punishment. And then by the time you reach the Middle Ages, you have the church actually actively involved in imposing the death penalty upon people. These are things that the cross should shame.
absolutely right. And the I don't know, just the bloodlust that is caught up in that. I think it ties into, I think this, the capital punishment bit ties into another chapter that you do that has to do with essentially this, the scapegoat mechanism, right? Or scapegoat theory. But the capital punishment bit just baffles me so much. The retributive justice, which in my mind just sounds like vengeance, right?
I mean, you could you could just say retribution, and you don't have to try to tag justice onto it.
Right.
Because it's just vengeance. It's just revenge. It's just, that's it. And yet, understand that part of the canonical text of Americanism is all of these cowboy movies, which, come on, we're all somewhat seduced by them. I think most of us, at least at some point in our life, we just love those Westerns. But they all have the same theme and plot. They're all revenge tales. That's all, they're all that. But then that's part of what it means to be an American. And that's what places us at times at odds with Christian faith. And then we try to find a way to conflate the two, but actually it never works.
Hmm. Yeah, cause, I mean, the revenge bit flies in the face of something that, I don't know, maybe Jesus said, like, love your enemies or something like
Exactly.
that. I don't
Well, and not just Jesus, the apostles and the early church fathers and the entire
know.
early church for 300 years.
Yeah. And I mean, too, even, you know, to think about the cross reminds me of a God who chose to die at the hands of those persecuting God rather than to kill God's enemies, right? And it's just, I don't know, it flies in the face, and it gets to at one of my favorite passages of scriptures when in the garden, and Jesus is about to be arrested, and you know, one of the soldiers draws a sword, you know, and Peter cuts off his ear, basically. And Jesus heals the dude. Like, heals his ear. And when I've talked about this with friends in the past, and like, see, look, this is showing, like, if there was ever a time to use violence, it was right now. And Jesus was like, nah, put the swords away, healed the guy that was going to attack him. I mean, it ultimately led to his death. And they've just been like, oh, well, you know, that's just Jesus. He had to fulfill a prophecy. That's the only reason he did that kind of thing. And it's just such this backward logic in my mind
Well,
that
let's remember, you know, and this is one of the chapters in the book. The call to discipleship is take up your
your
cross,
cross, yes.
follow me. And in the context of the time, cross had no connection with piety or religion or spirituality. It was simply a means of Roman execution. And so Jesus, the cross is not just something that Jesus does for us. Yes, Jesus dies for us. I get that, but it's not limited to that. Jesus also says, now take up your cross and imitate me. Don't just stand on the sidelines and applaud for me. Take up your cross and imitate me. And that, I talk about that in the chapter, I think it's just called The Road of Discipleship or something like that, but that's where I work with the fantastic, highly recommended film by Terrence Malick, my favorite film director, A Hidden Life, which tells the story of Franz Jägerstätter. So I'm plugging that, people. If you haven't yet seen A Hidden Life, written and directed by Terrence Malick, on the true, it's the true story. I talked with Father John Deere, who was and is a friend of the family, the Jägerstätter family. He knew Franz's widow and he knows his daughters. And he told me, he said, when he was a consultant for the film, and he said, it's a faithful reproduction of the life of this man who lived a hidden life and was a martyr and wasn't known until relatively recently. And so I highly recommend watching the, it's beautiful. It's an example of grotesque beauty. Ultimately, it's a story about a man who ends up, spoiler alert, being beheaded by Nazis. And yet the film itself is gorgeous, just beautiful. So highly recommend it.
Yeah, I have not seen that, but after reading that chapter, it went down on my list.
Yeah, you're gonna want to see.
Yeah, but the excuse me, it's that's inspiring though too, because it I mean, this kind of idea of a hidden life ties in nicely again back with like the whole Lord of the Rings bit, right? And the kind of grasping for power or grasping for popularity, and just this is a story of an individual who lived out their faith in a way that was not getting high praise. They weren't, you know, getting the most downloads on YouTube or, you know, whatever. Ultimately paid the price of their life. And again, it wasn't, the story wasn't told until later. So there was no tangible, like they weren't making money or something like this off of their
Yeah,
experience.
so that chapter, I end the chapter with how the film began. No, I don't know how the film ends. No, it ends like this. So this is actually the close of George Eliot's Middlemarch. And she writes, this ties in with, this is Hobbits and this is Jägerstätter. All this, it all comes together. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric accident. She means they're unrecognized, unreported. So the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. That's good. That's good.
It's very good. It reminds me, it calls to mind too. I've recently, again, it's these damn Episcopalians rubbing off on me. I picked up a Book of Hours, specifically Thomas
my
Merton.
Book of Common Prayer right here. I mean,
yes, know. Absolutely. Look, I describe
Word of Life Church as rock and roll Anglican. That's,
I love that. Yeah. But I was reading Merton. This is a Book of Hours where people compiled some of Merton's work. And yesterday, when I was doing my daytime prayer, one of the bits that came through that really stood out to me. Let's see, where is it? Essentially, yeah, here we go. So it was the Kyrie for the day. And it said, Merton says, writes, "Keep me above all things from sin. Keep me from loving money, in which is hatred, from avarice and ambition that suffocate my life. Keep me from the deadly works of vanity and the thankless labor for pride and money and reputation." Mm. And that, I mean, talk about a hidden life, but also that, that hit me really hard as somebody who constantly struggles with comparing myself to others, right? And asking, like, oh, well, I've been doing my podcast for 5.5 years now. How come it's not as popular as this? Or how come it's not that?
We all struggle with that, Josh. All of us.
but that
we continue to struggle is good.
Yeah, and that
self-aware and say, okay, I need to push back on it.
Yeah, the recognition of a hidden life and just learning to be content with what I have, but also just continue to be faithful with the call that I feel, or lure as a process person. I like that word better. It means the same thing though. Being faithful to this moment, that kind of idea of a hidden life really speaks to me in that regard, I guess. Are you okay on time? I want to be fair to time. Okay. One thing that often comes to mind for me when thinking about the cross and, I guess more specifically atonement, is that I was kind of always grown up being given this hyper individualistic understanding that, the cross is for me.
That's because you're an American, but go ahead.
Exactly. And so one of the gifts that I think liberation theology offers is actually a more expansive understanding of this. So I'm thinking of someone like Andrew Sung Park, who has a wonderful book called Triune Atonement. And Andrew is a Korean scholar, and they have this concept called Han. And essentially they recognize that the cross isn't just for those who have sinned. Because that's a really great way to support oppressors, right? Like, if you're oppressing people and you need a theology that's like, forgives you for that, great. But it recognizes those who have been sinned against, and that the cross is more holistic, and it's this more communal understanding. And so I'm curious for you, like, when you think about the cross in a less individualistic lens, and maybe more so in a more communal or entangled lens, like, what kind of comes to mind for you?
Well, I think towards the very end of the book, I start really leaning into the universal nature of the salvation of the cross. Jesus says, "And I, when I am lifted up, will draw all men to myself." That's nice, draw, but that's not what it, I mean, David Bentley Hart, in his translation of the New Testament, translates that drag And then if you look at how that verb is used elsewhere in the New Testament, that's what, for example, when Peter, after the resurrection, has the miraculous catch of fish and he drags that net up onto the shore, or when Paul and Silas in Philippi are arrested and they are dragged before the magistrates. And so if my favorite chapter to write was the chapter on the Lord of the Rings, the One Ring to Rule Them All chapter, I think the best chapter, if I can pick out, or at least I don't know if it's best, my favorite chapter is chapter 19, The Center That Holds. And I work with the Orthodox Anastasis icon, but I'm really working, but the one that I portray and actually describe the most is Ivanka Demchuk's contemporary icon, modern icon of Christ descending into to say hell, Hades, Sheol, dead, descending to the dead and taking hold of Adam and Eve, or Adam and Hava, humankind in life, and pulling them up out of their tombs. And so I think salvation is best understood as a kind of belonging, not as a private individual transaction, you know, between me and Jesus. But it's a kind of belonging. God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world. And I think ultimately all things are rectified and healed at the cross, both the sins of the oppressor and the wounds of the oppressed, but also understanding more deeply that the wounds that the oppressor inflicts upon the oppressed are also the wounding of their own soul, and all of that has to be dealt with and eventually healed in some way. So yeah, I think it's better or best to always think in terms of salvation in a communal sense. You know, we have this phenomenon in English. Part of it is just our language, that along the way we lost the second person. Which one did we use? Plural. So we can't tell in English. When you see you, you don't know if it's, you just have to guess from the context whether it's singular or plural. Mm-hmm. Now in Old English, you know, you have thee and thou. You can make distinctions, actually. This is where King James Bible will help you.
Yeah. Right.
But what happens is we read Paul's epistles and imagine that all of the yous are about me, when virtually all of the yous in Paul's epistles are y'alls. They're plural. They're speaking to the community, not to the lone individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. For me, just that recognition of the communal too, I feel like carries more weight. And in that, or perhaps, I don't know how to say this well, weight, motivation, something like that. Because when it recognizes that my salvation is deeply and intimately tied up with your salvation.
Right. Yes.
And my salvation is deeply and intimately tied up with the salvation of my neighbor and of my enemy and of all of creation. That is a deeper calling that has motivational power, perhaps as a way of saying it, or that's a nice divine lure to recognize that we're all in this together. And for me, that's one of the gifts that I think, you know, process thinking, but not just process thinking. I mean, you get this in a lot of Eastern philosophy and religion as well, but the deep interconnectedness and interrelatedness of all things.
You also get it in Eastern Orthodox theology.
Absolutely, yes.
This is everything you just said sounds just like Elder Zosima and the brothers Karamazov, who is a fictional character, but based upon Saint Tacone, and is actually based upon a real person. And he talks about taking responsibility for everyone's sin. And this is the way the East, even this sounds strange, the East, even in the West, but, you know, the Eastern Orthodox, which is Western, but it's the Eastern part of the West,
right?
Talk about salvation.
Yeah, it's more holistic and in my mind, more beautiful. So I guess, all right, I'm going to ask you one final question, and it's a weird one, so forgive me. And it's a little bit outside of the scope of your
book. I don't mind weird.
But I think you'd be down with it. So in regard to this kind of more communal or holistic understanding of salvation, something that comes to mind for me is the deep kind of anthropocentric nature of theology. And I mean, that makes sense, right? We're humans, we're talking about God, it's going to be anthropocentric. But as we continue to learn and grow more about the universe and, you know, study cosmology and these kind of things, I feel like a cosmic understanding of something like the cross is important, right? Like, there's a good chance that probably aliens are a thing. I don't know if we'll ever meet them, but like, it's probably a thing. So if you were to think more cosmologically, right, how do you think the cross speaks in that larger scope? That's if we, you know, get rid of the anthropocentrism.
Yeah, I have thought about this, but I don't have a good answer.
Sure, I don't think anybody does.
Let me just muse a bit here.
Yeah.
Is there, you know, as the saying goes, intelligent life elsewhere? By the way, Contact with Jodie Foster, written by, what's his name? Forgot his name. Anyway, that's one of my favorite films. I love the film Contact. You know, it seems like there should be, right? It seems like there should be. Now the problem, though, is most people just don't understand. I mean, if there's much hope of contacting, we're going to have to get over the problem of the speed limit. You know, if Einstein's right and the speed of light is, that's a speed limit. You can't go faster. I mean, I know it sounds fast, but in the vastness of the cosmos, it's slow. And so there could be all kinds of civilizations out there that we just can't encounter because the distance is too vast. But what if, I mean, why assume that every civilization, or however we want to talk about it, I don't even know if that's the right language, has been corrupted by sin? Maybe we're unique in that too. I just saw something recently, just within the last few weeks. I can't, was it a cartoon or did I read it? It was something like this. We do make contact with a alien civilization, and people want to know, do you know about Jesus? And I say, oh yeah, Jesus. Great guy. He comes by ever so often. First time he came, we gave him some pastries and it was beautiful. What'd you guys give him? What'd you guys do? Oh, funny story that.
Yeah, right.
So I feel like I don't think your question's weird. I have thought about it. I just don't have a ready reply.
Sure, sure. It's a big question.
It is a big question. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
Plato said that at the center of the cosmos there is a cross. Plato said that.
That is interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, it is a big question. It's and perhaps a bit of an unfair one, but I don't know. It's just
I mean, it's a fair question, but a fair answer is also, I don't know.
I think it's a good answer. <I don't>. Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I like the, again, it picks up on this understanding of mystery, right? Mm-hmm. And not in a cheap way. Like, I don't want to throw out mystery in the sense where it's like, well, I don't feel like answering a question, or I think you got me, so it's the mystery of God. But I think more so in a way that's maybe awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, like, oh, I don't know. You know, something like that. And kind of being willing to sit in that and wrestle and experience, you know, experiment with ideas. You know, Whitehead it talks about an adventure of in ideas, and yeah, so it's just a fun place to go and think about. If God's at least as big as the universe, then probably the cross is too. I don't know. So, well, Brian, this was a lot of fun. I am going to be honest with you. I don't know if you could tell when we started. I was very nervous to have a conversation about the cross and atonement. It's not something I've talked about in a long time. But I, in all seriousness, I commend your book, The Wood Between Worlds, to people like me who have been hurt by the church and damaged by like really shit versions of atonement theology, because I think you handle it in such a beautiful way that doesn't just give one answer, but rather a plethora of beautiful images, and invites us into, yeah, I guess the beautiful poetry, poetic understanding of the cross. So thank you for doing so. And thank you for connecting me with the world of the cross again. I appreciate it genuinely. So
thank you, Josh.
Yeah. Hopefully our paths cross again in the future.
Where are you? I don't know where you are.
So I'm in Baltimore, Maryland. Okay. Yeah, but I'm around. I hang out in places. If theology's involved, I tend to stick my nose in there. Yeah, it would be a lot of fun. Okay. Yeah, well, listeners, snag yourself a copy. I promise you won't regret it. I'll put a link in the show notes. Brian, is there anywhere else you would like people to go to find you and your work?
I mean, you can. I'm easy to find in that I have an unusual name, Brian Zahn. I'm the only one. So you can Google me and you'll find the good, the bad, and the ugly. You'll find podcasts, sermons, and books, and you'll find cranks on YouTube that are just convinced I'm a heretic. And you'll find it all.
Happens to the best of us. Well, cool. All right, Brian, thank you again so much. And listeners, as always, thanks for hanging out today, guys. And go in peace.